The program you are about to hear, Philosophy in the Classroom, was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television license fee. The program is co-produced and presented by me, Hugh Hick.
And by me, Ger Cunahan.
Anyone who has had any experience of young children, once they find language, after they've got through saying no, no, they will start to say, why, why, why? Now, really, I suppose from an educational perspective, where we're coming from is to keep that why alive, to keep asking questions, to keep wanting to know, to keep wondering, where do the stars go during the day? How do animals know when to wake up if it's spring? And all of these, how does the tide turn? What makes it turn? What makes it go back and forward? They're all questions that children have asked me when I was in the classroom myself.
This is Dr. Philomena Donnelly. She's talking about a system she's developed called Thinking Time, an experimental approach to introducing primary school pupils to philosophy from a young age. We first came across Thinking Time after reading an article in the Irish Times about Ciara Williams, a teacher in St. Benedict's School in Ongar and a former student of Dr. Donnelly, who had been piloting out Thinking Time with her senior infants. We were intrigued by the notion of philosophy being brought into the classroom at a very early stage of a child's development, and decided to explore the possibilities of philosophy being an integral part of the curriculum, both in primary and second level. Is it really necessary to prepare a child for life outside school walls, or would it simply take time away from other key skills expected in an increasingly competitive economy? To begin our search for these answers to these questions, we decided to visit Ciara in St. Benedict's and see exactly how Thinking Time worked.
I need to see everyone in your seats.
Okay.
And I need to see everyone with their mare at the veil.
I started really the end of September in junior infants, and what they have to do is that we all sit around in a circle, myself included, and I'll ask them a question.
Our question today, boys and girls, is it ever okay to tell a lie?
I don't really think it's good to tell lies, but small lies can be a little bit okay, but big lies are different.
I think it's not okay to tell lies because you might get in trouble.
In the beginning, now, I have to say it was pretty difficult because they weren't used to the model, and sitting them around in a circle, I just remember they were rolling around on the floor, found it very hard to listen to each other, weren't really sure how to respond. But as time goes on, it's just about practice.
I think it's not okay to tell a lie because you hurt someone's feelings.
One parent actually came to me recently and said that she noticed just that her son was a lot more curious and asking a lot more questions at home, kind of about the world and, you know, why do things happen? And I suppose his natural curiosity is being developed. So she was saying that she's noticed that now, especially this year. And she's delighted with it as well. And I think it's great as well that they can go home and that they can think about things, or think about, you know, questions that are important to them, and know that they can come into school and they can discuss it once a week. I have to say, I think the parents are happy with it.
And you find yourself, when you're teaching other subjects, do you see any rollover from the Thinking Time in terms of how they engage with other things you might teach them?
Yes, I think so. I think their listening skills have been developed, definitely, and their reasoning and their questioning. They know that they can question things and they don't just have to sit there and accept everything. So I suppose their confidence as well and their self-perception, own self-perception, is being developed as well, which is great, and their self-esteem.
I think you can tell small lies but not big lies, because this my life is only a joke.
Why do you think this idea of getting children of this age to engage creatively with subjects such as philosophy hasn't caught on in a mainstream sense in primary schools all over the country?
Well, I suppose it's not a new concept. It's a concept that was developed by an educational theorist called Matthew Lipman. But like that, I suppose it's about raising awareness and teachers being willing to kind of, you know, discuss it in schools and to promote it in schools, and, you know, for teachers as well to be able to observe and to see that it is worthwhile and the impact that it can have on young children. And like that, like if they start very early, if they start doing philosophy in junior infants, imagine what it'll be like for them in sixth class.
I think it's okay to tell small lies because you won't get in trouble that much.
I don't think it's okay to tell a lie because you get in big trouble and use some punishment, stay in your room forever and sitting down.
As part of this documentary, we're going to be examining not only philosophy as it's taught by people like yourself at primary level, but also examining whether there was any way it could be fit into the curriculum in second level. Do you think, given the way the curriculum is structured in second level at the moment, do you think that's feasible, or do you think there's any way this could be transplanted into second level?
Well, I would hope so. I suppose the way the second level education is, you know, it's very much based on results and the junior cert and the leaving cert. So I think there would need to be teachers and parents and students would need to be educated on the value of it. And I suppose it needs to start in primary schools in order for it to feed up to secondary schools. But I remember myself when I was in transition year, I actually did philosophy for that year. And I mean, it was fantastic and always looked forward to it. Like that, it's a chance for you to say what you think and to speak your mind. And, you know, I think awareness does need to be raised about it. So I suppose if that happens, then I definitely think that it would be feasible, without a doubt. If it's feasible in primary school with children at a primary school age, it's definitely feasible for children at a secondary school age.
Do you think that certain kids, like, you know, the group dynamic with kids and certainly being in a group, do you think some of them might be afraid to express their true opinions or ask questions for the fear of being ridiculed?
I suppose it could. I think really, with infants, I think they're all, this class has started from the beginning, so they're quite comfortable with each other. And I suppose that's just something that comes with time. I've noticed with the third class now that I've been doing it with for the last few weeks, in the beginning, when they do agree with each other, or they do agree with me in the beginning, because they don't see it as equal, really. They kind of see it as, oh, if teacher's saying this, then teacher must be right. And it does take a while for them to come to become comfortable with the fact that no, I don't think the teacher's right, and that's okay. Or yes, I agree with teacher, or yes, I agree with my friend, or I disagree with my friend. And that's where kind of separating the idea from the person comes in. It does take time, and I did notice, particularly with the third class in the beginning, they were all agreeing with each other.
Kira suggested that we call in on Niamh Murray, who is the teacher in charge of the third class pupils that she'd recently piloted Thinking Time on. So after saying our goodbyes to Kira and her class, we moved a few doors down the hall. After setting her class some work, Miss Murray was happy to take a few minutes to give her assessment of how Thinking Time had fared in her classroom.
For about the last 3 or 4 weeks, Miss Williams has come up to the class for one afternoon for about half an hour, 45 minutes. And what she does is she gives them a question to think about before she comes up to us, so the children have had time to reflect on the questions and come up with things that they might like to say. I knew that she was piloting this with her class, but then she, as part of the course, was asked to do the similar thing with children of an older age group. The children in her class would be four and 5 years old, where mine are that bit older, where they're 8 and 9. So she was looking to see how the same questions posed to older children and the differences in the answers that they would give. But I was more than happy to volunteer my class, as it will do nothing but benefit them as well. And it's very interesting for me as a teacher to watch and see what answers that they come up with to the questions that she poses. It's really building and working on them listening to each other and knowing that it doesn't matter if they have a different opinion to their best friend. They can still be best friends and have different opinions and still get on with each other, even though they have such different thoughts on things. So it's been brilliant to see, and it's really benefiting the children.
Do you think the fact that they're that bit older and they aren't used to this might make them a bit, did it make them initially more self-conscious?
Although it is a new concept, and they have, from the time that they were in junior infants, been doing through SPHE lessons, been doing things like circle time, where they are used to speaking out in front of the group. So I don't think they were necessarily self-conscious about speaking out, but you could see initially that when they'd when somebody would say they disagreed with someone's opinion, there was initially a little bit of a, they'd be nearly a bit put out by it, but now they're kind of learning that just because it's a different opinion doesn't mean that it's wrong. So they're becoming, I think, more tolerant of other people's ideas, which is, can, like I say, only benefit them in the long run.
And is the curiosity that they're displaying in this transferring over to the other subjects to try to teach them, or is it too soon to really tell?
I think it is making them probably more inquisitive and like that, more open to questioning things and questioning each other's opinions. But I'd say it'll probably take a bit longer before I see that coming into other areas. But I've no doubt that it will, because I know it has with Miss Williams' class. She would say that they have become a lot more inquisitive and think about things in a different way. So you can see elements of it creeping in already. I'd say it will take a bit more time, and it is something though that I will hopefully continue when Miss Williams has stopped with the class. It's definitely something that I will continue and will try to do with classes I have in the future, because I've seen nothing but positive things coming from it.
Niamh believes that it's important for children to think of the world in a broader way from a young age, and that models such as Thinking Time feed into this and strengthen both their personal development and their relationships with other people.
It's developing that skill from such an early age of developing their own opinions of the world and their own thoughts on things. And it is completely different to other subjects and other ways of learning, in that it is not just rote learning off, this is how it is. It's completely led by them, however they steer the conversation, which is a breath of fresh air. And it is nice for once, for it's not all led by the teacher. You go with the children wherever they take the conversation, I think that's why they like it so much, because it's completely, they have ownership of exactly what they're talking about.
So far, so good. Everyone we had talked to in our time at St. Benedict's seemed hugely enthusiastic about how Thinking Time had played out in the school, but there was one person whose opinion we hadn't heard yet, that of the principal, Nora Behan. We wondered whether, in her role as an administrator as well as an educator, she would be more cautious towards such an experimental approach. However, she seemed as emphatic in her praise of Thinking Time as anyone.
Oh, I thought it was wonderful. I think the primary school curriculum, really, it does, advise us, and it would be very much developing the children's critical thinking. And being a teacher of infants myself for many years before I became principal, I think there lays the foundation for further learning. If we can get children to look at what they're asked, to think about what they're asked, to actually question things, then I think that goes right over the curriculum in every subject. So I was absolutely delighted when Kira came to me and said she was doing this with infants. I think that's where you start.
Were you at all concerned that you might receive objections to this by parents who might be afraid of what might come out in these classes?
No, not at all. And we would have a very good relationship with parents here, with our parent teacher association, our parent body. And I know Miss Williams herself, Kira, would be very open and very approachable, as we would the whole school. We have an open door policy, really, to parents. But no, I wouldn't have been afraid at all about anything. I think, you know, children are reared differently to these days, very different to when I was a child. And I think, you know, treating children with that kind of respect and letting children question, I think you can only further develop their critical thinking, their judgment on things. And I think, you know, there isn't always a right or a wrong. We're not always right. Just because we're teachers, we're not always right. And I think that builds up a fantastic rapport with the children and the parents.
Nora points out that there was a similar system called Circle Time, which St. Benedict's had used before Thinking Time, that shared many of the same characteristics, where children could share thoughts and feelings, and crucially, could choose whether or not to contribute. Circle Time has in some form been used in schools worldwide as an early social tool for children, but its loose structure means it generally lacks the philosophical focus of Thinking Time. Nora believes that, historically, the Irish primary system failed to give its pupils opportunities to question things around them.
Going back in the very old days, where you had very big numbers, really, you know, and it doesn't look like they're going to get very small right now, but we would have very big numbers. I mean, I was very lucky. I was in a two-teacher school in Kerry, a very small school, so I suppose it was very personal. But, I mean, when my teaching career started, I had 45 children, and there wasn't the time, really, and children probably you know, we're expected to listen and just take what you said. You were the lecturer rather than the facilitator. And I think this is a good thing. I think, you know, there wasn't as much as that. Because really, if children buy into something and if they feel they can question things, you know, their involvement in it is surely greater, which I feel would have beneficial effects right through their lives, really, and right through their learning in school too.
It was a fascinating experience watching Thinking Time at work, and we both left St. Benedict's curious as to how it evolved to the point we saw it and why it wasn't more widespread. We decided to visit Dr. Philomena Donnelly, who you heard at the beginning of the programme. Dr. Donnelly was a former director of the Graduate Diploma in Education at St. Patrick's College, Drumcondra, where she expanded the educational research of academics such as Matthew Lipman into Thinking Time.
My own journey is very simple. In the late 80s, I was doing an in-service course. I was in the classroom. I was in Bayside Junior School in Sutton. And I did an in-service course in St. Patrick's College. And Joe Don, a lecturer in philosophy of education, was there. And in the course of a general lecture, he mentioned this idea of doing philosophy with children and the work of Matthew Lipman in the States in the 1980s. And I was very curious. And I spoke to Joe after. And he simply said to me, look, if you're ever going to do something about that, let me know. So I was, and I started to try out sort of this idea and playing with it, if you like, with a class of infants that I had. And Joe very kindly came out and sat in with them. Now, the advantage of that is that Joe has philosophy as an academic background, unlike myself, who had lots of experience of teaching but didn't have that. So working together on that, we came to the format. I think it was him. Now, this may sound very simple now, but in the late 1980s, people would have raised an eyebrow. It was him who said to me one day, why don't you let them out from behind their tables? So in fact, we started putting them in a little circle, and these things evolved very nicely. And in fact, we there were certain criteria involved that we passed the tip around and children could express their opinions. We would have modelled things. Well, I think, or I wonder, or is this always true? Well, maybe there's another way of looking at this, or perhaps trying to push the language that goes with it, or saying, well, I agree with you when you said, and in time saying, I disagree with you when you said. Now, once one or two children had picked that up, the rest of them picked it up very quickly from each other. So then, in fact, it was a child referred to it as Thinking Time and said, can we do that Thinking Time?
Dr. Donnelly drew heavily from the work of writers such as Margaret Donaldson, whose book Children's Minds argued that good abstract thinkers do well in any education system.
The point she makes at the end of that book is, if, as we know, that people who do well in any education system are good abstract thinkers, how, therefore, are we helping children to think in the abstract throughout their education? And now, in my own research, a lot of the teachers who I worked with would say things like, it was the time and thinking time that was most important to give children. And that might only be 35, 40 minutes per week in order to talk about what they wanted to talk about and to explore that verbally. One of the functions of thinking time is that it helps children who may not find it as easy to write their thoughts, to speak their thoughts.
Dr. Donnelly soon found that thinking time had a profound effect on how her pupils engaged with each other, and it brought a new sense of equality and community to the classroom.
What happened was, this particularly one little boy I had, and he was going to learning support. He was socially very outgoing and all of that, but he adored thinking time. He always spoke. He always said awfully deep thoughts. It changed both my perception of him and other children's perception of him. So if you like, that social sort of order sort of changed. Certainly because I knew he had this ability, because I heard him speak these thoughts, his own thoughts, unlike, say, something that you had asked them to learn and repeat back to me. These were thoughts that were originated in their heads and in their spoken words. So the fact that I knew he was so much capable is that I made more demands of him. And of course, you know what happened, because I made more demands and stretched, sort of, if you like, the scaffold higher, he reached higher. And so in that sense, that was important too, from a teaching perspective.
The little boy in question left a big impression on Dr. Donnelly, and she recalls one time that he taught her a lesson about the importance of dialogue.
We were in the middle of thinking time and we'd been talking about should animals be locked up in the zoo. The children had asked to talk about this. And there was one little girl in the class and she was very, very passionately clear that animals shouldn't, and it was a horrid thing to do, and how would we like if animals locked us up and came and looked at us, and blah, blah, and so on went on. Now, initially, this little boy had said that he loved going to the zoo and he'd never see an elephant if there was no zoo, and he'd have to go to Africa and he couldn't go to Africa. Therefore, he liked the zoo and he always went to the zoo, blah, blah. So then he went on ahead round, and but it came round to the second or third tip round, and I'll call the child Alice. It's not her real name. But anyway, he then said, I was listening to what Alice had to say, and I think she's right. So I agree with Alice now. And then he paused and he said, that means I disagree with myself now. Now, when the child said, I nearly fell off my chair. Like, in all my adult life, had I ever heard anyone, even an informal even over a dinner party, saying, actually, you know, you're right, I disagree with myself. Your argument is solid. And I look forward to the day that on prime time or some sort of one of your own radio programmes where you have politicians or people who will come on and say, you have a very interesting point there. I think I will go with that, or I'll change my own position. That's dialogue. That's what real dialogue, that's new meaning, new understanding taking place. But as I say, I learned that from a child.
And did you ever have a situation where you didn't exactly know where the line is with thinking time? If you're asking them these philosophical questions about right and wrong, did you have any concerns about what the parents might think?
Well, I have a little example of this from my own classroom. Now, it doesn't become an issue because both the children and I think parents, and good practice is that you always inform parents what's going on in your classroom. And certainly over my own years of research, I involved parents and did questionnaires and all, and they were very supportive of it. On one occasion, I don't know how it came up, but the children were, I think they were to, could we live forever? And was the question that I asked to talk about. And some of them said that it wouldn't be a good idea because there wouldn't be enough space, and some people would have to stand in the water to live. And I actually think that maybe they're way ahead of their time, and several decades, according to the scientists, we'll all be standing in water anyway. Anyway, apart from that, in the midst of all, came up about how you die and you go to heaven, and children, I mean, they will, particularly around senior infants, about pets dying. It's a huge issue for children and where they go and all of that. So it was an issue that mattered to them. But they were talking about it, and in the middle of this, a child said, but God is dead. Now, I immediately thought of Nietzsche and said, my heavens, what's coming next? But anyway, they went on to say, and he argued his theory very carefully, and he pointed out that God is dead because God is up in heaven, and if you're up in heaven, then you're dead. Therefore, if God is up in heaven, he is dead. Now, a lovely piece of a sort of good logic good thinking in that sense. But I let it go. But it was the only time in my own teaching life now that I sort of had a qualm and said, oh my, it was early 90s, I think. And I was thinking, oh my gosh, you'll have parents up on Monday complaining about senior infants going saying, God is dead. But in the context, no, not a bother. They weren't the least perturbed, and the children discussed it and about all the rest. And some argued that he wasn't dead. He was down in the church. And some thought it was horrible that to leave him there all the time and not let him out and all those things. So in that sense, do you know, children are thinking these things.
After hearing the interesting insights that thinking time brought out in primary school students, we couldn't help but wonder what second level pupils would make of the subject. Philosophy is currently nowhere to be found on the Leaving Cert syllabus, however we did manage to find a secondary school that offered it as a core subject. The Lycée Français in Clonskey prepares its students for the baccalauréat, the French equivalent of the Leaving Cert, which includes philosophy as a core part of its curriculum. Pierre Cassin, a philosophy teacher with the Lycée, allowed us to visit the school and explained exactly how philosophy works in the context of the baccalaureate.
They have two parts. They will have a part of the exam in fifth year, and they will have two or three topics in the fifth year, and they will have the rest of the exam in the sixth year, and in total they will have around 10 subjects, I think, and each subject have a certain coefficient. We have two mainstream in the general baccalaureate, because we have vocational as well, but we don't propose it in the French school here. The general baccalaureate would have three streams: scientific, economic, and literature. And in these three streams that you choose when you are at the end of the fourth year, you will have your topics with different coefficients.
Essentially, what Pierre is saying is that you have three subject streams in the baccalaureate, depending on your interests. In all three of the options, you will study philosophy, but how many hours every week depends on the stream. In the literature stream, it's 8 hours a week. The science stream does 3 hours a week, while the business and social sciences stream has 4. At the end of the day, though, you will study philosophy.
It is very important for their higher education, and the higher institutions, they are really looking for the comments and the marks as well in philosophy, because it is relevant. It shows the open-mindedness of the student. It shows that their curiosity, their ability to argue. So it is very important even for scientific students.
Pierre introduced us to two of his pupils who are studying philosophy, Edward and Mercedes. We asked them to give us a sense of what sorts of topics they actually discuss in their classes.
Well, recently we studied the relation between a state and the people that live in the state. And we studied the different type of relations they can have within the state. And that's probably the last topic we did. It does make you think about things that you wouldn't originally think about. You tend to ask yourself questions that on a day-to-day basis you probably won't ask yourself. But that's the interesting part, because it comes out of things that are simple, and you start asking yourselves questions that probably make it a bit complex. When you come to it, it does become interesting, and you do feel that sometimes you're able to speak in class and think about those ideas and give your opinions on them.
We have had disagreements that are just in class. When we are out, we are all friends. We know that it's just philosophy, and that's the goal of the subject, that we can say whatever we think.
The bell rings, and Edward and Mercedes leave us for class, giving us a chance to discuss Pierre's view on philosophy in further detail. Pierre believes that in his classroom, philosophy opens a new pathway in thinking that focuses on criticizing the consensus in every field of thought.
At the end, they have to understand that the opinions are the starting point of their work, but basically what they have to think about it and what they will think about it after the class or after a four hours exam should be different after the work that they put on the first stage on their opinions.
For Pierre, one of the great benefits of studying philosophy as a subject is that it forces pupils to engage with topics in a creative manner. Second level education has traditionally been strongly associated with textbooks and rote learning facts and figures which are later examined in a way that tests a student's ability at total recall more than their analytical skills. Pierre sees this as a shortcoming that subjects such as philosophy go some way to addressing.
That's the problem as well that I think is very important, is that some students, they have problems with concept. They are quite able to think about facts, you know, example images probably about, you know, from TV, but a concept that you have to give a definition, see the consequences, evaluate the relation between this concept and another one would be much more difficult. They have practical way of thinking, and sometimes the first time they have to make general statements is in philosophy, you know. So I think if they start earlier, it would be much better in final year.
Why do you
you as a human being, not as a teacher, why do you love philosophy?
It's more something that would put you into question. So that's not all the time a good feeling. But at the end, when you overcome your opinions, you have this fantastic feeling that you are not in mistakes anymore, or maybe you're not found the truth, but you are closer to something called the truth. And that's something that I never found anywhere else.
There's one point that Pierre is firm on. He dismisses the notion that philosophy is in any way irrelevant in today's society, and instead argues that the skills that a student develops are crucial to a rounded education and just as practical as in any other subject.
The ability, you know, to not take things for granted, to try to argue in a very precise way, to be comfortable with concepts. As I said, the problem with some students is that they have a too concrete way to think. You know, they think with images and facts. So this capacity for an ability for abstraction is really something that business school and lots of institutions are looking for. And that's something that could make a difference as well during an interview. That's something that could make a difference in your career, okay? Definitely, you can see people having no ability to have critical thinking. And that's something, basically, that you can't learn from a thinker or from a philosopher, but you have to practice. The class has to be seen as a practice of philosophy. You know, when you're learning piano, you're doing your scales. Well, learning, thinking about philosophers, that's the same thing. That's an exercise that you do, but you obviously have to overcome that and get a personal teaching style. But it's doing your scales. Learning philosophers is doing that. Like in piano, and I think it's a general skill, life skill, and you can make a difference with that, definitely.
At this point, Pierre stops abruptly.
I would like to add something about philosophy again, because I don't want to give the impression to people that's blah blah blah. Okay. So, no, philosophy is quite precise. What we request is precise. We do not accept relativism, the idea that each ideas are bringing half the same weight. We don't really like that.
A quick lesson on relativism for those who aren't familiar with the term. In philosophy, a belief in relativism equates to a belief that there is no such thing as a universal truth, and that no argument or moral standpoint is intrinsically better than another. An example of ethical relativism would be the concept of slavery. Proponents of relativism would argue that while slavery is morally wrong to most people, that doesn't make it morally wrong in an absolute sense. It can be an uncomfortable argument, and relativism of any sort remains controversial both in and outside of philosophical circles.
Relativism has some good, has some interest, obviously, but the essays that finish with the idea that where we can see everything and the opposite are not good. Okay, that's why the maybe at the end of the essay wouldn't be that good. And we are able to say that an idea is better than another one because of the way it is argued.
We hear the term life skill quite often when discussing philosophy, but even after meeting Mercedes and Edward and hearing their evident passion for the subject, we wondered how much it would really stand to them once they began to enter a job market that is focused on qualifications and marketable skills, particularly since the downturn in our economy. We decided to ask Konstantin Gurdjieff, a noted economist who has spoken about Ireland's difficulties many times over the last several years, whether philosophy as a life skill could really translate into something valuable to the economy.
My view of the matter is that education should be really viewed as a kind of life cycle approach to instilling both the ability of people to learn and to discover, but also, obviously, the ability of people to acquire skills and the acquisition of skills. And again, if I think about philosophy as a kind of structured field, broad field, I can't really find a single, actually, area of philosophy that to me is either irrelevant in the current modern environment, both workplace environment or economic environment, but also social environment.
Konstantin mentions logic and ethics as two crucial areas which aren't directly taught in schools, but are nonetheless essential in the workforce. He worries that with the rising obsession with skill-oriented learning, we are failing to adequately develop well-rounded adults with the necessary broad education our economy requires.
Financially and economically, I think that it is not only feasible, but is imperative. We are currently entering the stage where our competitiveness as the society, not just the economy, but as a society, our ability to attract the right talent, the right skills into the country, retain them in this country, raise them in this country, and then also enable them here, will be crucially dependent on the education system ability to deliver well-balanced, highly, truly highly educated, thinking and creative workforce. And right now we're failing in that, because what we're doing is we're teaching students at the secondary level to respond to the, to produce Pavlovian level responses to standardized tests. That is, frankly, put, is 19th century thinking, and probably back then not the best practice to begin with.
After speaking with Konstantin Gurdjieff, we wanted to know if philosophy was being considered as a subject for the second level curriculum. Dr. Noel Kavanagh, a lecturer in philosophy at Carlow College, was part of a group of academics who pushed for philosophy as a second level subject.
For the last 3 years, I've been a member of the Royal Irish Academy's Committee for Philosophy and Ethics. And when we began our tenure 3 years ago, a little more than 3 years ago now, we had decided, myself and a few others with the chairman, Dr. Brian O'Connor from UCD, as to what could we do during our tenure as in some ways the voice of philosophy in Ireland. And the conclusion we came to was that if we were to be of practical use as well, that we would push the Department of Education and the NCAA, the National Curriculum people, to include philosophy at second level in Ireland. To bring us in line, by the way, with the major countries, Central European countries of the European Union, where in Germany, in philosophy, in England, and in other countries, in Italy, where it's been there for decades, and they understand and know the value of it. That came to a head in 2012, where we submitted to the National Curriculum and the Department of Education an outline for a module in philosophy at second level. After several meetings with the curriculum people, which was very, very popular, it got very great support. Unfortunately, we received a very curt reply from the Department of Education last year to say, no, I'm not interested.
Can you explain why the proposal was rejected?
Well, we don't know really. There was no huge explanation given. We can only think that in the present climate, that there is a focus on the utilitarian nature of education. What can that get you? What can this? Where does this lead to? And we talk about in education now. We talk about pathways. So the student who does English or history or science or accountancy in second level has a pathway to third level, which has a pathway to a very well defined job. Of course, philosophy doesn't do that. And perhaps the decision from the Department of Education was that because it is of no utilitarian use, then it is of no use at all. Now that leads us to a larger philosophical question about the nature of society, which philosophy wants to question. What we would strongly advocate for is philosophy in second level, because it provides and nourishes critically thinking young people so that we can tackle those questions of the day. It's not as if, by the way, that students won't, that second level students won't think. The question perhaps is that they may think less well without philosophy. What philosophy teaches us to do is to be critical about the ideas that are presented in front of us. They also, as students of the history of ideas, will be able to historically contextualise where our ideas, our givens, the things that we don't question, where those things actually come from. And of course, when we do that, we see them for what they are, products of a certain time and place. And that actually allows us to be far more critical about our society. Perhaps that's the undercurrent of why people are so reluctant to have philosophy in second level, is that it creates questioning critical students at secondary school level. And perhaps that's not what we want. But the larger question would be, do we want a society or an economy? If we are only educating students for utilitarian purposes, we are educating them for an economy, but not for a society. And perhaps the argument would be had that if we had philosophy at second level, perhaps the great mistakes that we have made in our economy over the last decade or two wouldn't have happened to the extent they'd happened, because people would have been educated and trained to question the "should we be doing this?" sort of questioning that philosophy encourages students to do.
If our audience today is a group of 15 or 16 year old secondary school pupils, how can we sell them philosophy? How can we say, well, now, if you had critical thinking or even better critical thinking abilities or skills, this would happen in your life, or you could do this? Could you give me some sort of an example?
Social media. It's constantly is the question that comes up is the separation between public and private life, the rights that perhaps should accrue to a private citizen, and how social media now has blurred the divisions between those. We often get situations now where young people don't perhaps understand the difference between public and private spheres. And if you present them with the dilemmas, then both ethics within philosophy and political philosophy and the idea of how we relate to the social to the public and private are the questions that they naturally are thinking anyway. And this is the point that we would like to make, that these kids are thinking about these things anyway. When I talk to next door neighbours' kids, they're the ones that are saying, "Oh, I don't know whether that was right or not," or "I don't know whether that." The biggest one of late was that young lady at the NMM concert, where she was engaged in an amorous act, and that became a viral social media thing. Now, my next door neighbour's kids, 15, 16, 17, constantly debated that in the garden that summer, and I constantly debated with them. They didn't know they were doing philosophy, but they were doing philosophy. And the more I told them that the arguments that they were presenting were in actual fact arguments that are well established in philosophy, then it was them, then they kind of, and sooner or later, three of those kids came to me over the summer and said, "Is there a simple philosophy book that I can pick up?" Because it had sparked their interest. So it's those sort of ideas. Kids philosophize anyway. We all philosophize anyway. It's just to be able to contextualize those in the history of ideas that would allow us to educate our children to be critically thinking students, to ask the why question, to ask the ought we be doing this question. It's vitally important. All summer long I was happy and free, saved my soul. The board of education took away my control. I gotta go back to school again.
After hearing Noel Kavanagh discuss the benefits that philosophy on the secondary school curriculum would have, both on a student's third level studies and in the workplace, we learnt about the concept of higher order thinking, which is essentially a student's ability to analyse and question the information they study rather than rote learn. We wanted to find out more about higher order thinking and what effect its introduction early on in the education system would have once students reached third level. To this end, we contacted Dr. Jones Irwin, himself a lecturer in philosophy at St. Patrick's College, Drumcondra, and asked him to explain a bit more about the concept of higher order thinking, and indeed why he feels it isn't currently emphasised on the curriculum.
Higher order questioning is really philosophical thinking. Students being able to be facilitated by teachers, but then to actually autonomously develop problem-solving skills for themselves. Now, too often, I think the education system, not simply in Ireland, but, you know, in many ways in many countries, has adopted what, say, another philosopher that I've been working on recently, Paulo Freire, a Brazilian philosopher, says is a banking system of education, where the teacher simply deposits the information in the student. And that really is the opposite of higher order thinking. It's lower order thinking. And too often, the points race, in the Leaving Cert particularly, rewards lower order thinking. So people who don't think, but to a great extent just simply regurgitate, which, you know, can be a canny quality in itself to be able to regurgitate in the right way, in a sophisticated way, This is lower order questioning, but that has been rewarded in the Irish system, whereas higher order questioning, that kind of autonomous thinking, has not been rewarded. In fact, it has been punished. And we see this, I suppose, also in the fact that subjects that are central to that notion of higher order thinking, philosophy, sociology, psychology, these are subjects which haven't featured in the curriculum in an Irish context. And I think we have to ask ourselves the question why that is. And again, I would suggest that one of the reasons is because there is a reserve at best, or a real tendency against that kind of philosophical higher order thinking in an Irish context, because on a civil society level, if you have populations, as we see now in Turkey and Brazil, where there has been a lot of philosophical thinking going on, you see that it can lead to a lot of civil unrest. And in Ireland, we haven't had that kind of civil unrest. And to a great extent, that kind of passivity, I think, is a feature of our education system. But hopefully, we can be hopeful that that's beginning to change.
Apart from the benefits to society, Dr. Irwin also believes that philosophy plays a vital role in the development of an individual's sense of self and search for meaning.
Philosophy enables the person or the student to actually work through, to a great extent, their own difficulties, or at least be able to confront their difficulties and the issues their values or meaning in a way that is constructive for them. And I think that the combination of a subject like philosophy with psychology and sociology at second level wouldn't resolve the issues that we have, but I think it would go a long way to helping. And I think, you know, again, it's more than ironic that the subject which is now in the second level curriculum is religion, given that, you know, religion in many ways was the meaningful discipline for so long in Ireland, but for many teenagers now, there's a sense in which that doesn't really suffice to give them meaning. So I think we have to be realistic about the changes in the society, and we have to work towards creating alternatives to religion for value making and meaning making for our teenagers, and indeed for our adults in the society.
Emmanuel Kant was a real piss, and he was very rarely stable. I digger was a boozy beggar, if you think you under the table. David Hume could have consumed Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, and Wittgenstein was a beery swine who was just a schloss to Schlegel.
Throughout our investigation of the possibilities of philosophy in the classroom, we seem to keep hearing one key message over and over again. The earlier a child is introduced to the concept of philosophy, the greater the benefit to them in later life. Remembering our time in Ongar and our experience of thinking time, we wondered how that system would work with a group of children who had never done it before. We contacted St. Lawrence O'Toole's Girls' School on Sheriff Street and asked would we be able to come in and pilot a session of thinking time on a group of sixth class girls who would have been older than the pupils we saw previously in Ongar. We decided to stick with the question of, is it ever all right to tell a lie, and delivered it under the same conditions as we had already witnessed.
Sometimes it's bad to lie and sometimes it's all right to lie. Because, like, if you don't want to hurt, like, just say you said something to your friend and you said you're going to do something with them and then you told a lie while you weren't going to do it. That's why sometimes you wouldn't. That's why sometimes you wouldn't want to tell a lie.
My name is Chloe. It's good to lie sometimes, because if you plan, like, a surprise party for somebody
and like they wanted to know, you'd have to lie and say something else about it. Like, not, don't say like, yeah, I'm having a party for you. If it's a surprise, you have to lie about it.
It's all right to lie, but it depends on what situation there is. Like, say if someone asks you, like, say if it's your best friend or something, and you say, oh, are you going, where are you going today? And you say, oh, I'm going uptown with my mate. I can't go with you, but you're not. You're just going with someone else. And so that's called betraying as well, but still, it's still a lie. And then you keep keeping a lie in Toronto and your friendship is over and no one likes you.
Like, if you're not allowed anywhere and you go there and your mate, like, rings you and says, like, where are you? And you're, like, uptown, but you're not really. You're, oh, sorry, you're in your friend's house, but you're not really. You're, like, in the pictures or with your friends. And, like, did you see any of my money anywhere? And you're, like, no, and, like, you took it. But, like, it gets worse when she finds out.
We realised quickly that this session was going in quite a different direction to the one we experienced in St. Benedict's. Instead of the broad and simple answers we heard there, these ones became very specific, and it was difficult to imagine that they came from anywhere but personal experience. It may have been the difference in age, or the fact that they hadn't been exposed to this type of exercise before, but I wondered whether the point of thinking time was being served as well here, as the replies became more and more intensely personal.
I told a big lie once, and I regret it. It was a little silly, like, it was about, like, who brought stuff upstairs and then who left them up there. And then I lied and my little cousin got upset and then I got barred off stuff, so.
I told a big lie before and everybody believed me, but then I felt bad. I said that I had a big sister in England and she died. And that she fell off. She went to India and fell into a big tank and got eaten by sharks. I told them about, I lied to my friend saying that and then it wasn't true. And like, and get karma over line, you can get karma. And like, and I told them that my best friend died in a fall.
If other girls tell a story about someone in their family or their friend dying, then you just like want to like have a story and then you want to fit in with them. It's like,
can I say something? Some people tell lies to impress people, impress their friends, and then when they impress their friends, and then just say there was like a group of people, and then they had to lie to like get into the group, and then the friend find out that they were lying, and then you won't have any more friends. Peer pressure and all stuff like that.
I know what it's like to be lied to, because I've been lied to loads of times. Like I've been told like you're gonna, like you ever get one like. You get told something, but you're going somewhere, just say, and then it comes to that time you're supposed to go to this place, and then something else comes in, and then you can't go to that place. Like, I wouldn't like to be lied to because it just hurts your feelings.
While the discussion had been open and at times captivating, I couldn't decide whether our experiment was altogether successful. The responses had been honest and direct, but I somehow felt that the philosophical aspect of the question had somehow got lost along the way, and instead it became a place where the pupils swapped stories on a topic. I wondered whether any of them would leave the classroom that day with any further insights on the act of lying. After our thinking time had finished, we decided to ask their teacher, Serena Doohan, how she felt the session had gone.
Yeah, it was good. I think it's good for them to, they're always encouraged to do lots of oral work anyway, so it was good. I suppose the only thing would be to make sure the other kids weren't talking at the other time, and maybe if you questioned them a bit more, like probed their question, like whatever they were saying. That'd be it, really.
And in terms of the direction the exercise went, I noticed compared to the way it was in Ongar was done with, I suppose, senior infants, very different age group. And I noticed that very quickly during that exercise, people started relating it back to their own lives, and it went from a discussion about the very basic abstract morals of the lies to people starting to relay their own anecdotes of how it related to them. How did you feel about that?
Well, I suppose they're always talking about their own lives anyway, so I'm well used to hearing every possible story already, really. So it's quite normal for me to hear all that. Yeah.
What do you think the benefits or drawbacks of this exercise was, were it to be, I suppose, something that you find in schools like this?
No, it's good, I think, to get them discussing and maybe increase their vocabulary and think about things outside the box and stuff.
And so our journey into the world of philosophy in various classrooms around the country was coming to an end. Our attempt to try out Thinking Time ourselves hadn't been a complete success, but there's no doubt that more experienced educators such as Kira Williams and Philomena Donnelly were finding huge results with their classes. Throughout this programme, you've heard a lot of anecdotal evidence as to the success of experiments like Thinking Time, but there are also scientific studies to chronicle the positive benefits to children. A 2004 study by Dr. Steve Trickey and Professor Keith Topping analysed the effects of a 1 hour a week philosophy course for primary school children in the UK. They found that even this 1 hour a week promoted social and emotional development, yielded sustainable gains in cognitive ability, and increased critical thinking skills. In a report on the programme, Ofsted, which is the Office for Standards in Education, Children's Services and Skills, found that, and I quote, "The thought-provoking and exciting curriculum the school has developed over the last 2 years is an outstanding component of the school's success. This includes the development of philosophy for children, a powerful tool which both excites the pupils and gives them the confidence to explore stimulating and challenging ideas and concepts. It not only strengthens their academic learning, but also encourages their empathy for others and gives them insights into the adult world." Philosophy still has no official place on the syllabus in any primary or second level school in Ireland, but even since we began making this programme, the calls for its introduction have got louder and louder. With the greater need for creativity and abstract thinking in workforces all over the world, it's difficult to imagine that philosophy will remain outside the classroom for much longer.
This programme, Philosophy in the Classroom, was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with the television licence fee and co-produced by Gerard Coonahan and Hugh Hick. The producers would like to thank the contributors to the programme: Kira Williams, Niamh Murray, Nora Behan, Dr. Philomena Donnelly, Pierre Cassin, Dr. Noel Kavanagh, Dr. Jones Irwin, Konstantin Gurdjieff, Serena Duhan, and all the pupils at St. Benedict's in Ongar, the Lycée Français in Clonskee, and St. Lawrence O'Toole's on Sheriff Street. The programme was made with the assistance of 103.2 Dublin City FM.